great opportunity to create some merit. The rest of us are fairly polluted, but they're not yet. Color all, thank you. Lavender, one of my favorite colors. Okay, Chris. No, I'm kidding. It's okay. Put it right there. All right. So we're going to start out we'll do the prayers starting on page 34. You guys know the prayers? I guess we'll just have to sit through those. But y'all are so well behaved, I can't believe it. It's great. Alright, so we're going to do the prayers, and then we're going to do some mantras which the kids can participate in. And I'm going to bring in a new tune. I know that some people will be upset at me by that, but I will just do it anyway. And then we'll let the children go. Do y'all want to meditate? Do children want to meditate? You do? Okay. Let's just sit quietly for just a second and create a little mental separation between everything that led into coming in here today and right now. And close your eyes and just pay attention to your breath. Now we're going to do it. We're going to do it together. Now, I said this. I didn't say this first time. But before we do the refuge prayer, what are the two or three things you need to be thinking about before we do the refuge prayer, so that it's not some empty, meaningless ritual, which I think a lot of people are really turned off. They think, you think, oh, these prayers and all this is just empty, meaningless. But it's not, if you understand. So what's the motivation for taking refuge? What's the two or three things that we need to be thinking about before we say this prayer? Pardon? Love, kindness, compassion. That's like what I had in mind, but those are all good things. Yeah. Getting out of some sorrow. So we'll call it dread. Dread of living with the kind of mind we have, caught in a process of uncontrolled causation. It's like, hey, we have to really have some recognition that we have an issue, which is our mind and life, and that there's a possibility to stop our suffering and find, really true lasting happiness, a kind of a joy and a freedom that is unimaginable. That possibility exists. So that's the dread of having a crazy mind like we have is number one. And number two is what?
Right there.
Yes.
Peace, love, and compassion.
Peace, love, and compassion. That's number four. Number two, but that's a good one. That's a very good one. Number two is what we call confidence or faith. Or some kind of, like, we've tested the path, we know that it's valid for us, and then we are willing to take refuge. So you have to have confidence, or a kind of a faith from having tested Buddhism over time, and then we need to have this sort of sense of dread that if we go on with the kind of mind we have, our life will not get better. Most of us will take the path, throw it in front of us and walk right back into it and do the same thing over and over again. And we need to break free of that. So that's really what we have to have faith in, is that this path is a way out of that kind of habitual negative behavior. So that being said, we're going to do the third one is compassion. Compassion, that's a mantra to me. I don't know about you, but those sounds don't bother me at all. He can stay. But so compassion for yourself and other beings. that this path can actually empower us to help ourselves and become literally a lantern guiding other people from suffering into the supreme enlightenment. So those are the things that we think about rather than just, you know, popping off with these phrases and not thinking about the meaning. All right, so we'll do refuge in bodhicitta. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence. Turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Now this is, again, we're imagining that we're offering a universe of everything that is bountiful, jewels, and you name it, for the teachings. It's like we're willing to give up anything for the teachings. So that's the attitude of the mandala offering. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as the Buddha fill and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratnam Mandala Kamne Yata Yami. Alright, now we're going to go over to the Chinrezig. We usually do that, right? Chinrezig and Green Tara. Now, I've got a different tune though. Sorry. I get it right. So I'm going to say it one time myself and then y'all can join me for a little. I have to get it in my head. Om, Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Alright, now Tara. Om Tari Tu Re Soha. Let's see, my turn. You have to pay attention, just catch it, it's different. Now I've forgotten it. Let me see. Om Tari Tu Re Soha. Om Tari Tu Re Soha. Om Tari Tu Re Soha. Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. Om 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 Tari Tu Re Soha. Okay, so we can go. So this is the new Christy Minstrels version of the mantras. No, but you're all too old, young to remember them, but they were good. I'm sorry? Oh, I know. I love the mantras. I like different tunes. Speaking of Christmas caroling, when I lived in Greenville many years ago, we had a little Buddhist group, and I'm heading to go to a funeral after this. My third mom, this woman that I consider my mother to me, she he died on Thanksgiving Day. So, but anyway, when I lived in Greenville, our little Buddhist group, we decided to do Christmas caroling. This is a bunch of Buddhists, right? To go Christmas caroling to all the people in Meals on Wheels. And, you know, so these are mostly elderly, shut-in people. And so, you know, we all grew up Christian, so we had all the songs and stuff, not really great voices, but we did our best. We go in there and go Christmas caroling, and these people would inevitably say, "Who are you?" You know, and we just say, "Oh, we're just some people who are interested in singing," and they would cry. They were so happy to have somebody come and visit them during Christmas. So this is a time, you know, the holiday season is really a good time to reach out to people and particularly those people that don't get a lot of attention. But anyway, we were all over town, doing this, and it was one of those situations where we got way more out of it than we put into it. That'd go good on my college resume, wouldn't it? I went on a mission trip and I got so much more out of that than I put into it. If you don't have that on your college resume, you have no chance of getting in. But it's true that, you know, giving really does benefit the giver many times more than it benefits the person who receives it. Andre, you are so good. Thank you. But I'm covering up my socks. Come on, Robbie, look. It's my trademark since I stopped wearing neckties. Okay. So, have you got my phone?
Yeah.
Thank you. So, we're going to start out with some meditation, and then we're going to open it up to discussion. And so things that are on your mind that about anything really. And we'll try to answer it with put a Dharma spin on it. That would be the goal. So we'll start out just doing mindfulness of the breath. So you Geshe-la teaches exhale, inhale. You can count softly, one. You don't have to, but this is one way to get your mind to hang in there with the breath. So exhale, inhale, two, exhale, inhale, three. And of course your mind will wander off, and when it does, you gently bring it back, because your commitment is to stay with the breath, so you gently bring it back without beating yourself up or any sort of assessment. Judgment about it, and then come back to the breath, and you have to start all over again. I'm going to do this for a few minutes. remember some of the teachings before we start. One of them is that one of the important teachings is to remember impermanence. And they say that you should remember it at the beginning of the practice, if you're doing any spiritual practice, particularly in the beginning, in the middle, and in the end. If you remember it in the beginning, you'll bring some attention and awareness to your motivation, and you'll realize what a precious opportunity it is, and then in the middle it'll help you keep your attention sharp and your focus sharp, because you'll want to benefit as much as possible from the teachings, and at the end remember impermanence and how rare and precious the teachings are. And you know, hopefully we create causes for more of these teachings. So it's kind of like that. And impermanence is both gross and subtle, isn't it? It's subtle in the sense that we're not the same people we were even like 10 seconds ago. Our body and mind are in a constant state of flux. Constantly, inexorably, you know, going, until we die, until this gross physical body dies. But it's happening all the time, subtle changes. We're all going through these subtle changes that we don't recognize until we look at the picture from 3 years ago. We go, wow, I have changed, or they have changed. I remember both subtle and the grosser aspects of impermanence, very important. And then as Mahayana Buddhists, we try to recollect and generate something called, I think maybe some new people here, but we call it the awakening mind, the Bodhi mind. But it's the most important thing that we'll do this morning. It's just in this next couple of minutes is to set our motivation in a positive way, in a powerfully positive way. Certainly motivating for happiness today, and so you don't not so stressed out with your family or your work or whatever, or your health problems, is certainly you know, not bad. It's not a bad motivation, but the motivation that we want to shoot for is it sounds a little bit pie in the sky, but it is crucial. And it's that we aim for our own happiness, to achieve our highest potential as a human being. Our highest potentials for love, wisdom, compassion, skillful means. We set our sights on these, developing these qualities within ourselves solely to be able to perfectly serve others. So really, the goal is, I want to serve others. I want to help others. I want to make a difference. I want to be a positive force in the world. I want to not just help them with food, clothing, and shelter. I want to serve them in terms of guiding them from their present state of confusion all the way to supreme happiness. And so it's something that they have to realize within their own mental continuum. That's what I want to do. I want to guide them to supreme enlightenment. And based on love and compassion, not some sentimentality, but based on genuine feeling of interconnectedness and compassion, we then engage on a path of personal development, of self-exploration and transformation, you know, to develop the qualities within ourselves. And we call it in Tibetan Buddhism, we call it the Lam Rim. It's a graded path to enlightenment. It's not like we have to invent this. There's not a medicine for it. It's something that it's work that we can do on our own mind to shape and mold our mind into something that is supremely joyful and happy and can serve others. And so that is the motivation. As much as we can, we try to set our mind, our goal for practice with this intention. And then to let that intention kind of pervade the next hour and maybe the rest of the day, but at least the next 45 minutes while we're here. A book, in case I get stumped, called Dear Lama Zopa. In fact, I should probably be reading from this book rather than talking, but anyway. So the first class, we had some lively discussions. This class, or this session, could be a lot more boring depending on how many people want to speak up. But I asked last time, has anybody ever been to a Zen retreat? Nobody's hand went up. Yeah. What do they usually do? What does a Zen teacher usually say?
Well, I go to a Zen practice that's not really the traditional Zen, but in the retreat, usually we have some sort of theme that we're exploring, and we do a lot of meditation. It's a silent retreat. But then we do have some group discussions where we kind of loosely explore the theme, and then people see how it arises for them.
Right. So, but one of the, that kind of leads into what I wanted to do this morning was normally what we do is we have we'll give a teaching on the eight worldly dharmas or different things, But in some traditions, like in Zen tradition, the teachers usually say, okay, now where are you? Let's talk about where you are with your practice. How is your practice working for you, not working for you? What's going on that, in other words, where are you? Because you're much more interested in where you are than what I have to say, so, usually. So it's, and then Sherry Huber, this lady who I adore.
That's the Zen Center.
Oh, really? Yeah, Sherry's so wonderful. Anyway, she's like somebody I really respect. She says, and if nobody has anything to say, we'll just sit here for an hour, which I'm happy to do. So anyway, anybody have any questions? Oh, good. Oh, Andre. Thank you.
I think the last time I talked to him, I said something about emptiness. So I'm always trying to understand emptiness because I think it's essential. I think it's incredibly important. Or I don't think that the Buddha would even mention emptiness if it wasn't. And so I'm trying to understand it. So I get that emptiness is that all things are simple, meaning that all things are merely labeled by the mind, and all things exist independent on causes and conditions and so forth. I get that. My question has always been, all right, what is not empty? Is there anything that doesn't exist in that way? And that's my question. That's what I wonder. I know exactly, I know that all phenomena, now I get that everything is like a projection that, I'm putting on to something what's coming from me. I get all of that, and that is that's really profound and really practical for me. It really helps me to be able to to navigate in this world.
So how does that help you navigate?
Say it again.
How does it help you navigate?
It really helps me, especially in the way I look at it. I look at it in how I see others. And I think that's extremely important. When I work in the prisons, this is what's going on with these guys. Everything is based upon their past experiences. Everything is based on what happened to them. And so they project that. And then they project that onto someone else.
Uh-huh.
Right? And what it is they don't recognize that what they're seeing or how they label this particular person, whether it's a guard or whether it's whoever it may be, like
uh-huh.
a fellow inmate and so forth, they don't recognize that that's not who that person really is. That's their only projection.
Uh-huh.
And so if they see this person as being someone that's not a friend, I see this person as an enemy, then that's the relationship they have.
Right.
So they find themselves always in problems. So for me,
yeah.
I'm always constantly looking at people and realizing that what I see is a projection from my own experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I'm labeling this. I see someone dressed with sagging pants, chains,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. Then, you know, like I'm saying, well, this person, I could say this person's a gangbanger, right? This person may not be a gangbanger at all. So that would help me if I could recognize that's not who this person is.
Right.
I can see this person.
Right. See, I think that's great. I think that's the practical application for us, for ordinary beings, of the practice of emptiness. I know some people here have no idea what we're talking about, so I'll try to say something about it. But you know, when Lama Zopa was here earlier, this is alluding to the fact that, for example, if I'll try to remember to come back to this point, but I'm holding this up. Everybody sees, what do you see? Does anybody know what that is? Nobody knows what that is. Okay, I think I've had a pen here. No, everybody knows what that is. It's a book, right? Is that a book? Would you all agree it's a book? We have, unless you're crazy, it's not a book. But if it, now a dog might see something to chew. So if it were a book to read, the dog ought to read the book. The dog doesn't read the book, the dog chews the book. So the dog's having, my point is that we all have a different perspective on life. And in fact, right now, in this very moment, we're all having our own unique projection of Kadampa Center, Don Brown, the conversation that's going on. Am I happy? Am I unhappy? But somehow, you know, because of our mind, we, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but we almost arrogantly believe that our perception of reality is the truth. These prisoners who see these guards as jerks, they believe in it and they act out of that belief because they believe that they are really jerks. And the jerkiness of the guard is right there in the guard. Has nothing to do with my mind. It's there. Right? So the point is that there is no objective reality independent of our minds creating it. Alright? So when we understand that, our mind is creating our reality, but we don't operate that way. We don't operate that way. We believe everything we see. We got that person that, you know, my boss at work that's giving me 10 times more stuff to do than I can do is a bona fide jerk. My ex-wife or husband is a bona fide jerk, you know? And we believe that. And furthermore, we act out of that belief, don't we? In Buddhism, we say, there's no jerk that exists independent of my mind projecting jerk. So let's operate from that perspective. And if we fast forward, let's say we have some awareness of this, how would you go about your daily life? And when you wake up from your meditation on emptiness, what you do is exactly what you're talking about, Andre. You question your perceptions. You don't automatically buy in to things that you see. Lama Zopa says, see everything as like a dream. So he says, one day or 1 week or 1 month, you can practice this. Wake up and see everything is like a dream. Practice seeing, it's called, you know, seeing things like a dream. In a dream, when you get killed in a dream, and you know, you're not surprised when you wake up, but when you get killed in a dream, you know, if you have lucid dreaming, you know it's not really happening, right? And so you don't get all upset about it. So see, everything is like a dream. So even right now, look around the room and think, this is just a dream. There is reality, but not the one that my ego projects. It's different. So it's seeing things like a dream, seeing things like a magician's illusion. So what is it, a magician's illusion? I used to, when I read this thing, seeing things like a magician, I started taking magic classes. I used to have this, does everybody know what, I don't want to mess up your thumb, you know, your belief in magic, but anyway, there's this thumb that you can put a little ball in, you can take it off, and you can, anyway, and you, I used to do this with a lot of people, and it, you know, and they, particularly older people, you know, you go visit them in nursing homes, and they go, oh my gosh, how did he do that? You know, and then you pull a rubber ball from behind their ear, and I know exactly how I did it. I know, but they didn't see that. They thought it was real. They thought I really pulled the ball from behind their ears. But no, I had stuck the ball into the plastic thumb in here, and then when I pulled it out, they didn't see it. And then when I reached behind their ear, I reached in here and pulled that ball out. It was so cool. Magic. So seeing things like a magician would see his own illusions. So a magician sees that he's creating his reality, whereas everybody else is sucked into it. They believe in the illusion. The magician sees the illusion, sees that it's an illusion, doesn't believe it. So Lama Zopa says, see everything as if it's like a magician's illusion. Like, oh, you go, wow, I'm creating this person as mean, or I'm creating this person as really delicious, or I'm creating this person as a problem, or I'm creating this situation as a problem. I'm creating my cancer as a problem, or my stress, or my depression, or whatever. You know, you fill in the blank. So seeing everything, you know, like a magician's illusion is another instruction. So do that for a day or a week. Practice that. Then another way to practice emptiness, and I'll talk about a fourth way in just a minute. Another way to practice emptiness, Lama Zopa said, is to see everything as the object of refutation. Doesn't that sound interesting? The object of refutation. And the word, the Tibetan word, is gacha. G-A-G-C-H-A. Gacha. So, what I'm getting ready to say is this. If you, in the first class, a lady said, I'm really having problems with emptiness because I know I exist. And yet, you know, you're saying that I don't exist. Buddhism says I don't exist. And I know I exist. And I said, no, Buddhism is not saying you don't exist. Buddhism is saying that we, and I'm talking about you and I, we do exist. For sure we exist. Because there's a body and a mind. That's what exists. And based on that combination of a body and mind is labeled I or me. Just based on this thing called body and mind coming together. And that's who we are. And that's all we are. But what do? Ignorance projects a false sense of I, and we embellish it and blow it up and believe it's real, and we cling to that I. And we believe that I am the center of the universe. Everything exists for my happiness. If you offend me, you will become an enemy. If you say nice things to me and give me stuff, you'll become my friend forever. But then nothing lasts forever, right? And the next thing you know, your enemies are your friends and your friends are your enemies. But ego does this. Ego plays these amazing tricks on us. So it's, so practicing, you know, like, seeing, so when I say gotcha, what ego is projecting is this false sense of I, which is called the object of refutation, which means it's not real. So that sense of a false I is gotcha. It's the object that is empty, that we're empty of. It is not real. So when we talk about emptiness in Buddhism, I gave the example last time, but you know, it's like if you were told when you came into this room that there was an elephant in here, and I had played elephant sounds on my cell phone before you walked in, but then you walked in and you looked everywhere and you didn't find an elephant, you could say, well, I thought there was an elephant in there. I heard the sounds and the people at the front door told me there was an elephant, but when I looked around, the room was empty of elephant. There's no elephant in here. Well, it's the same way with emptiness. The Buddhist view of emptiness is exactly that. We believe in a fault. We believe in this falsely projected sense of I that we cling to so dearly, and we also believe that what we see out there is real and it exists independent of our mind projecting it. Okay? So this false sense of I is the object that's being refuted. You know, we're empty of that. In the same way that the room is empty of elephant, we believe there was an elephant in here, but when we look, we didn't find it. We believe that there's an I that exists a certain way, a reified, hardwired sense of I that's the center of the universe, but when you look for it, it's not there. We're empty of it. So that is a fiction. That is the problem that we all have. That creates greed, hatred, ignorance, pride, jealousy. All the negative karma in the world that causes us to suffer comes from one demon, this false projection, which is gaccha. It's the object to be refuted. And there's a gaccha on everybody. This book is gaccha because it appears to exist from its own side, independent of my mind. But I can promise you, a newborn baby wouldn't see a book, would they? Because they don't have the word book. They don't have the label book. You know, they would only see something. So it's like that. Our mind is constantly creating. So going around all day long and saying, gotcha, 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 gotcha. Everything is gotcha. Don't believe in the appearances of things. But remember that they are false appearances and question. This gets back to the very basic fundamental thing is really question appearances. Don't be sucked into it. Sound like Sherry Huber now. But don't believe everything that you see. You know, but really question it. Look at it carefully. It's very important. And then on a practical stand, from a very, very practical perspective about emptiness, because everybody wants to be happy, right? I mean, nobody's here today because they wanted to suffer more. I'm pretty clear. So we all want to be happy, and we want to know how to be happy, because Buddhism has something to say about that. And how do we be happy? It's so easy. Islam says it's so easy to be happy. No, it's not easy to be happy, but it is in a sense. And it's based on this reality called emptiness. If we realize that, for example, when we project, does everybody get what I mean by projection? Yeah. It's almost as if, just kind of go with this for a minute. It's almost as if there's a big movie screen out in front of you, and we are projecting my life, your life, male, female, young, old, ugly, beautiful, smart, whatever your adjectives are about you, damaged, good, depressed, joy, you know, whatever. Whatever we are constantly on this screen projecting an experience called my life. You get that? There is no objective reality. I have to say this again and again. There's no objective reality out there that exists independent of my mind labeling it. There is no objective reality out there that exists independent of my mind labeling it. That's very, very important to get, that we literally project our reality. It's so subtle what's out there, we can't even find it. I'm not saying there's nothing, but I'm saying just to kind of creatively align with what I'm saying. So we're projecting our reality. So who wants to project a happy life? Raise your hand. Who wants to project suffering and misery? Put your hand down. Nobody wants to suffer. Everybody wants to be happy. So if you want to be forced to have a positive experience of your life, the projection of being blissfully happy, being in paradise, having friends, getting along with people, you know, having a good life, having a good death. If you want to create that experience, how do you do it? How did the Buddha say do it? He said what? Create merit, positive karma. Create positive karma. How do we create positive karma? We don't harm living. We don't harm others. We don't harm others. We don't harm ourselves. We don't harm others. If you want to suffer, how do you? You know, shoot yourself in the foot. You might as well steal, kill, lie, commit adultery, slander, harsh, frivolous talk, greed, hatred, ignorance, and the 84,000 other delusions that are out there. You know, just behave in selfish, self-centered ways. Guaranteed, according to the laws of karma, you'll be forced to see yourself suffer. So virtue, and this is like God's not telling, according to Buddhism, this isn't like something written on a tablet. This is like enlightened self-interest. If we want to be forced to see ourselves as happy and have our lives working and workable, we need to create virtue. We need to practice virtue, which is avoid killing, avoid stealing, avoid sexual misconduct, avoid lying and slander and harsh and frivolous talk and greed, hatred and ignorance and all the rest. In other words, common sense, avoid anything that's motivated by self-cherishing. And in the moment, like the only way you really know, because most karma ripens in future lifetimes, the only way we'll really know, and this is only if we're paying attention, that the actions that we're getting ready to create are going to force us to see ourselves as happy and literally in paradise, is if we check our mind, pay attention, moment to moment to moment. We have to practice. We have to train ourselves to pay attention, to our motivation for action and have a bigger view of our action than just our little self-centered universe. So actions that are motivated by this is in the teaching. I'm not making this up. Actions that are motivated of body, speech, and mind that are motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance will always, you know, according to the laws of karma, ripen in the form of happiness. So happiness means that we are forced by our karma, because you can't change your karma the moment it ripens, can you? You can't. We can shape the future by making good choices, but in the moment the karma ripens, too late. But if we want to be forced to see ourselves as happy and having a workable life and having friends and getting along and having our lives work, it really depends on our past actions, on the choices we make. So we have to create positive karma. If we don't care, I mean, if you don't believe in karma, and a lot of people don't, I mean, let's be honest, this culture, pretty much people think, if I got by with it, you know, it's okay. If you can get by with it, it's okay. But, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, no, you can't take a vacation from karma. Karma will go with you to Atlantic Beach. It will follow you all the way to Jamaica and Rome and London. I mean, you know, the choices we make. Disney World, my gosh, that's even scarier. So karma is, again, according to the laws of this whole view of emptiness, is there's no inherent reality independent of our mind. So we are creating our own reality based on our former choices. And if we want to see ourselves as happy, we live virtuously. Not because God or the Buddha said so, but because that's how things work. Reality works that way. And if you want to see yourself, if you don't care whether you suffer, just keep on doing the same thing. Follow your ego. Be spontaneous if you want to. And be crazy and do things that harm others and yourself and act like you're the center of the universe. And I'm not saying any of you do that, but you know, there are people out there that do. It just leads to bad outcomes most of the time. Now, I'm sure you have somebody out there who smoke 3 packs a day and drink a fifth of whiskey, and they're living to the end of their 90s. But that's not the norm. You know, behaving and letting our mind run amok is not the cause of happiness for most of us. And we recognize that. That's why we're here, for most of us. We realize that the real source of happiness and suffering are not the circumstances in our life as much as it is our own interpretation of the circumstances and then how we work with the inevitable suffering, which is just part of being a human being, isn't it? Sorry. Okay. Yes.
Something about you talking of perceptions and how we see things. There was like an example what happened to me, particular, but I wonder what you can talk about, what you can say about that. When they have the relic tour, before that, I never heard it before. I had no idea what it was. And I came, and at first I was looking at it. I walked through all of them, and just looking at the beauty of the whole presentation, the artistic way, you know, like the beauty of all. But I had no idea what it was, so I was just, oh, wow, beautiful. And then I walk out, and I watch the video, and then I learn what exactly it is, all those little pebbles. And when I came back, I have a whole different view of all of that and a whole different experience. And that's what it, I wonder, like, how that the fact can affect your perspective.
Yeah, that's exactly a perfect example of how just in a few moments, by changing our attitude or our thoughts, completely changes our perception. Yeah. And there's no inherent reality in those relics, is it? It's your perception. Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. You know, there are certain things in Buddhism that have inherent power. Now, this gets into the part that's a little woo-woo, but I will say it. You know, it's and the teachers say it, and I don't have a problem, you know. What I call it's like karma and reincarnation and things like that I cannot prove definitively. I can creatively align with a lot of things in Buddhism, and this is one of them. Like, for example, seeing these relics has a certain power whether you believe in them or not. Whether you have that perception or not, there's a certain benefit to being around them and circumambulating them and stuff like that. If you go out here to the stupa, you know, now people who've never been here before, but those of us who were here when the stupa was being built, it's completely packed with holy objects and mantras and relics and amazing things. And at every stage, there were blessings to bless it, to consecrate it. And when it was over, there was a consecration ceremony and stuff like that. And so from a Buddhist standpoint, again, just even if you bring your dog and walk around it, you know, or even if a mosquito flies around it, but if you walk around it with some awareness that this is a positive thing that I'm doing for my mind, for example, you know, if you're sick, if you have cancer or you have a problem, come to Kadapa Center and just walk around this for an hour. And just think about all the benefit that you're doing for yourself and other beings by just circumambulating the stupa. The stupa is one of those objects that says has some inherent power, which kind of goes against Buddhist teachings, but it doesn't. So you just have to align with it for a while. And, you know, but try it. I mean, the worst thing could happen is, you know, you get in shape by walking around. So it won't hurt. And so Geshe Gelug always encourages, he said, I don't know if any of the teachings I've done gave today have been a benefit, but I know for one thing, if you go walk around the stupa, it will benefit you. So I really, you know, try not to come here and not at least make 3 laps around the stupa clockwise, ideally. You know, just do it. And it's okay. You know, you may not be enlightened right away, but it takes time. Yes. Any other questions or comments? Yeah.
So, something I've been struggling with is with the concept of karma. The concept of karma. Can you explain a little bit about how that makes sense when something happens to, let's say, a small child, age, you know, 3 or 4, who hasn't maybe put anything really negative out there into the universe, or is a really good person. That,
yeah. A lot of bad things happen to good people, even little people, even newborn people, even unborn people, right? A lot of bad things happen. It is karma. I mean, that's the easy answer, but it you know, that doesn't satisfy. I mean, to say that God did it to teach you a lesson, that really doesn't satisfy for a lot of people. And Christians struggle with it. And Buddhism has a pat answer, but it almost sounds like, oh, that's a cop-out too. But here's this is a traditional answer, and here's the point of it. The point of it is, for me, I'm just speaking from my own perspective, how many of us, when something bad, when somebody does us wrong, how many people immediately go to, I'm a victim? Pretty much everybody. Somebody cuts you off in traffic, you know, immediately you go, well, a little road rage. I spent driving around this weekend with a friend who's like, cussing at everybody, you know. I'm going, this is ridiculous. But anyway, you know, somebody, you know, you feel a victim. It's just human nature to feel victimized, isn't it? Human nature. And so, you know, so I think the teachings of karma mostly benefit the person who understands karma and is putting these teachings into practice in terms of seeing ourselves as responsible, accountable for our reality, right? That, as I was saying, what goes around comes around. So if I'm seeing my small child is suffering, my 4-year-old child is on a respirator, a ventilator, just got born, or is born with birth defects, or has Down syndrome, or is dying from leukemia at 4, whatever it is, if I'm not going, that child did something bad in a past lifetime to cause them to suffer. Now, Buddhism would say that child didn't do anything bad. But that mental continuum that went from lifetime to lifetime, and each time it's been reborn, it had to have a form. And in this lifetime, that mental continuum, just like a river, the Nile River goes through Africa, right? But it changes names through every country it goes through. In the same way that we have this stream of consciousness that one lifetime is a man, next lifetime is a woman, and it accumulates karma. So right this minute, your perception is the fruition of all of your former moments of mind, right? So this child didn't do anything wrong, but in the past, could have been a billion lifetimes ago. And again, I'm saying this is a convenient answer, and you don't have to buy it. But Buddhism would say it's explained by a past non-virtue that happens to be ripening at 4 years of age. It's not this child that did it, because this child has a separate ego identity. It's not, but it's the mental continuum that's had ego identities in every other lifetime. In this life, it's a different identity. It's a woman. It was a man last time. It's a girl this time. So it's like that. It's the continuum of the mind that has a ripening karma that causes little people to suffer and big people to suffer right on up to the time we die. It's our own former actions. Now, is it important to know what this child did to cause him to have leukemia? It really doesn't help. It doesn't help me with one caveat. It doesn't help me, for example, when I'm feeling victimized, to necessarily in the moment to go, well, I must have cheated on my wife in a former lifetime And so now it's coming back to me. Well, that could be helpful, you know, because, you know, maybe I'm going to practice really carefully to, you know, not harm anybody like that again. But in the moment, it's better to see things as a resultant. It's just a resultant. I'm never a victim. How can I work with this moment? How can I see it as a resultant and not create more negativity for myself? Because that's exactly what's happening. Karma's ripening all the time. It's a resultant. Can we see it as a dream? As like a magician's illusion? Can we see whatever we experience as like gaccha? It's like this, you know, this object of refutation. Can we see it in a different way? So, but getting back to the, you know, the child, look at 6 million Jews. My goodness, a lot of them were children. They didn't do anything wrong. But then again, you know, the Tibetan people, I mean, 2-3 million have been slaughtered by the Chinese at least, you know, and a lot of them would not have any recollection of their negative karma. But a lot of these Tibetans in exile and people that have been tortured, they see what's happened to them as a resultant. And they don't have animosity because, you know, to have animosity, pretty much have to be a victim, don't you? Like, they did it to me. And they see it as a result of their past negative karma. It's purifying their karma. And they just think, gosh, I want to practice really hard and not create that kind of karma again because I want to have a better life in the future. So there was one monk, His Holiness was describing this monk who'd been tortured for like 20 years. And he came, the Dalai Lama was given this example. And he was in a Chinese prison for 20 years. He got cattle prodded and tortured for 20 years. But he was a monk and he was a very advanced practitioner. And so, and when he finally was released from prison and he escaped over the Himalayas and went to Dharamsala and he was talking to the Dalai Lama and he said, and he told the Dalai Lama, he said, I almost lost it one time. And what he was saying was, I almost got angry at the people that were tormenting me. I almost got angry. In other words, he was able to use every situation that in his life that was ripening as suffering as to develop his heart and his mind. He could see it in certain ways. He could let go of his attachment to pleasure and not being tortured. You know, his fear of being tortured, his attachment to not being tortured, and his attachment to pleasure. He lived in the moment. And he could develop compassion for the perpetrators. Wow. Can you imagine? 20 years of torture? He almost lost it one time? That's just superhuman. Superhuman. But that is a possibility. So, you know, again, getting back to the basic fundamentals of the reality, if we want to live our life in accordance with the reality of the truth of emptiness, that there is no objective reality independent of our mind, the emphasis should always be on living ethically. Don't harm yourself or other beings. Try your best not to be selfish. Try your best to oppose the self-centered, egocentric mind and to operate in the exact opposite way. Be generous. Don't kill, save lives. Don't steal, be generous. Don't practice, don't be, you know, sexual misconduct, but have, you know, skillful, I'm saying skillful, but, you know, positive sexual morality. Don't harm people that way. Don't be deceptive. Don't, instead of lying, be truthful. Instead of harsh, frivolous, greed, hatred, ignorance, all that, do the opposite. Try to, you know, live our lives just common sense. It's not even a religious thing, is it? It's just common sense. When we act a certain way, nobody wants to be around us. When we act kind and when we're compassionate and when we're somebody who has a commitment to ethical life, it's completely different to be around somebody like that, isn't it? Do you feel safe around somebody who has a commitment to ethics and who believes in karma? I do. Now, somebody who doesn't care, wow. You know, you walk around like this, you know, like, whoa. You know, So, you know, I think this is one of the beauties of the Kadampa Center and the spiritual community. There's a lot of people here that really have a commitment. Now, we're all Buddha, you know, nobody's, I'm just saying, we're all a work in progress. So those of you who are new, please don't expect everybody to sort of levitate and leave the room. But, you know, but we're all working on living ethically and not harming others. So this is kind of a safe place to be, I think, if you're trying to develop yourself spiritually. So it's nice to have a spiritual community around you that has that kind of commitment. That's a long-winded answer. Yeah. All right, we're almost out of time. Well, I can give one quick answer. I've never given a quick answer. So this will be...
I've got a question about the end of that discussion, which is, if you find yourself in a situation where it's what you would perceive as a negative situation, something where things are not going your way, things are going in a direction you don't want them to go, is it considered egocentric to strive to change?
Even absolutely
if
not.
Something personal?
That is a very compassionate thing to do, is to stop harm. If you see something that's harmful for you or somebody else and you can't take it, listen now, some people... Let me just back up and say this. If you're a bodhisattva, you don't want good things to happen to you. You want challenges. Bring on the suffering. Because I'm committed to transforming my mind, and I can't do it when I'm staying in the Hyatt Plaza Hotel in New York, you know, with heated floors and a TV in the mirror. Put me down on, you know, in the Bowery or something, you know. But I'm just saying, you know, see, this is what I'm hearing you say is, you know, is there a place for strong action? Can that be compassionate? Can that be the sign of wisdom? And it's absolutely the case. If somebody is mistreating you, if somebody is mistreating somebody else, and you see that there's only one way to deal with it, you know, kind of like Christ and the money changers, you know. You go into the temple and you see these people creating all this negative karma, and you tell them, hey, get out of here. Nobody listens. And you yell, get out of here. And then you go in and you throw them out. You know? The Zen priest picks up the student and takes them and throws them out. Geshe Gelug might learn how to do that one day. Sometimes wrathful action is necessary, and it is a perfect expression of compassion. But it can also be the expression of anger and self-centeredness and your ego, and then it'll always lead to suffering. But social injustice and everything, we can react to social injustice without losing our cool. We can do it, instead of doing it out of righteous indignation and anger, we can do it out of, wow, this is really destructive for the people who are the perpetrators, the victims of suffering. You know, I can intervene with a positive motivation. And this exact same action comes out, which could look like a punch in the face. Could. Got to be careful when you start hitting people. Don't hit anybody. Don't go out of here telling Don Brown said hit people. I didn't say that. But it might be necessary. It's like spanking your kids after they go out of the street, you know, for the 13th time or the 20th time, you know, and you go, okay, well, here we go. One big good pop on the butt. And all of a sudden they don't do it again. Amazing. Okay, so let's wrap it up. Let's do the dedication verses. On page 36. And then we'll do the Green Tara Mantra according to Robbie Watkins' tune for Geshe Gelug's long life. Actually, wait a minute. Where's that? Anyway, there's one prayer, but I cannot find it. The Dalai Lama, the one from the Bodhicharva. Is it on 46? Yeah, Shanti Deva prayer. We'll do that. We'll do that too. So we'll go all the way. Yeah, we'll do Miksema, and then we'll stop at the bottom of that on the two thirds of the way down, page 37. Then go to page. Did you say 46, Robbie? Oh, 246. Sorry. 246. This is such a beautiful prayer. It would be nice to memorize this. I think my kids go to Episcopal school, and they go once a week to chapel, and they put this thing down, and they do the. I said, "What do y'all do?" And they said, "We pray the Lord's Prayer," and they memorized it. I said, "You know, we gotta have something in Buddhism like that." So this could be a very cool thing for children to memorize, like a nice prayer to say at bedtime and stuff like that. By the way, my children have been coming to Kadamba Center forever, but they appreciate all different religious traditions. All right. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. In this land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. O powerful Chenrezig Chenzengatso, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold a subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers, honoring the three jewels, savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Now, go to page 246. We'll skip Miksema. Okay. May all beings everywhere, plagued by the sufferings of body and mind, paint an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored when finding repose. May the naked find clothing and the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Now going back to 37, if you don't know Tara's mantra, we'll do Geshe Gelug's long life. Hey, so ha. Om Tare Tu Tare Ture So. See, next week, Geshe is still not here, and I'm supposed to lead the discussion, and it's going to be on respect. We'll have Aretha Franklin here. Get it things started. But anyway, and I give you some context because it's so big. You cannot believe how big it is. And I want a lot of input from you people. But back in 2000, I had a meeting with the Dalai Lama, and I said, "What is the most important thing in a relationship?" And you know, I was there with my wife at the time, and he said, "He didn't say but one word: respect." So that's pretty big. So I think I'd like you to think about that this week. And if you decide to come back, which I can understand if you don't, but if you do, have something. Maybe you can bring something to the discussion about that, because it is huge, huge, and we're all about relationships. And so, if this is the most important thing, we need to open that can and look inside and see what it really means. Let's see you next week. Thank you.